Well, I've made it to number 100. This is Chris Deasy. Welcome to number 100 in my Nostalgia Interviews podcast. And it was a massive pleasure to meet Pete Pafides, a music journalist who wrote a memoir called Broken Greek last year. It was the Radio 4 Book of the Week. And I learned after reading it and really enjoying it that Pete was a Lampeter student. He kind of crossed paths with me because I was in Lampeter 91 to 94 and Pete read philosophy just a couple of years before that. And he talks about his fond memories of rainy mornings in Lampeter and how different it was from the big city of Birmingham and moving to one of the smallest campuses in the country. He talks about hearing the sound of sheep at night, the notion of infinite choice, why he wrote Broken Greek in coffee shops, and how Lampeter kick-started the idea of the cafe as office. He talks about his reasons for writing what he calls a confusion memoir. We talk about childhood diaries, how music was an imperfect mirror of what was going on in the world around him. We talk about the concept of guilty pleasures and apply it to ABBA, why Hag's Record Shop is the reason why he decided to stay in Lampeter. We learn about what happened on Christmas Day 1977, involving a racist neighbour and an unexpected act of kindness. Then towards the end of the interview, we learn why writing Broken Greek was an escape of sorts. We learn why Pete came to write it, how he never thought he'd make a living out of writing as a music journalist. And also at the very end, we discover why Pete looks forward practically, but looks back sentimentally. It was such a privilege to catch up for the 100th Nostalgia interview with Pete Pafides. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is so fantastic to have Pete Pafides as my guest. And we were just saying before we started recording, Pete, this is kind of a dream come true, because I read Broken Greek, then subsequently discovered that you were a Lampeter graduate. And of course, there's me going around saying to everyone, oh, there's this amazing book about the charts and about growing up in the 70s and 80s. And there's so much about my life that it resonated with. Then I saw that you went to Lampeter. So on so many levels, I think we've got a lot that we can share this morning.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. And of course, you know, if I ever get around to writing a sequel to Broken Greek, then that'll be Lampeter will feature in it. So but I'm very excited and reassured by your backdrop, which is it's just so calming to see. For people, obviously, you won't know, the backdrop behind you is Lampeter itself, with the Lloyd Thomas Halls of Residence to your left, and then what is that? The terrace, Station Terrace?
That was Station Terrace with Magic Mountain behind it. And I took that photo, and it's funny because I've always written diaries and took quite a few photos in Lampeter, nothing much, but I took this one. It would have been October 91, and it was probably the very first picture, or one of the first pictures I took when I went there to do theology. I was on the top floor of the Burgess building. I had the perfect view, and it was obviously a beautiful day. I think maybe my parents had come down to visit. It was on a Saturday, and I just took that random picture, and I brightened it up a little bit. So obviously it's a tiny bit doctored, but you can see those.
On a sunny day, Lampeter was so beautiful. Actually, on a rainy morning, it was pretty beautiful as well. I was always an early riser. I used to love that kind of like magic hour you used to get before your mates had woken up, where especially on a Sunday morning when the place was completely empty and silent. And I've got fond memories of just like rainy mornings, just going to the newsagent, buying a newspaper, and just sort of, you know, effectively, you know, I was invisible to the world because no one else was awake. And a Magic Mountain just behind there. So that was, I mean, it was a bit of a shock for me because I grew up in Birmingham. And so going from Birmingham to Lampeter, in West Wales, smallest university campus in the country, I think. Yeah. It was really, you know, first couple of weeks were quite difficult, but I do remember because I had the halls of residence I was in were sort of the view out the back of them in my second year was that mountain. And it was just amazing. And, you know, you would get sheep grazing on there, and I just, how have I come to find myself in a, you know, this city boy in a place where I can hear sheep at night. And the thing you don't realize about sheep until you live near sheep is that, weirdly enough, they sound so much like sheep that it's almost like, actually, you almost feel like there are actually people outside your room doing an impersonation of sheep. There are sheep sound so comically like sheep. It's kind of it's almost like they're someone's trying to pretend to be sheep. That's all the only way I can describe it. And so, yeah, that's what I think of when I see the view behind you.
Yeah, and like you, I came from the city. It was Cardiff in my case, but whenever I was outside of Wales, people would always, of course, make those sheep associations. So, because I was quite used, if I was in Birmingham or somewhere, sometimes, you know, I was with people my age, they were always like, you know, doing these sheep noises. So, of course, when I went to Lampeter, I sort of kept thinking, hang on a minute, is somebody followed me from 1987 or something like that, you know, and I realised, no, this is Lampeter. And I think I acclimatised, I stayed there for 10 years, but the funny thing is, it's the kind of place that whenever anybody that I know now goes to, because they know I was there for all those years, their sense is that, you know, it's a lovely place, but why would you spend, you know, 3 years, let alone, you know, 10 years in the same place? And it's interesting because when you step away, you obviously think of all the wonderful friendships that you cultivate, and you have some, we all have great memories, and we all knew each other because it was so small. But the funny thing is, it's the sort of place that doesn't sort of fit with the rest of the world. It feels a place outside of time. And that's also part of its magic. So I can see both why I could, and at the same time, why for many people, it wouldn't be the kind of place that you devote that many years of your life to.
Yeah, I missed it terribly when I left, you know, and even in the summer holidays I missed it, you know. Sometimes I would look for excuses to drive back there, and then I'd get there and I'd sort of think, why you know, I guess it just became home. And and life that, you know, I've got an old friend who I used to do some work for while I was at Lampeter, a guy called Dave Bardsley, who was a sort of mail order record dealer. And I used to do a bit of part-time work for him, just a kind of preparing orders to be sent off. He lived in a house, kind of a flat/house above, I think, the butcher. And he was a student there in the early 70s, and he just stayed, and he's there now. And he just never left. And I can see the appeal, because life is just very simple. You don't have to travel anywhere. All the shops you need to sort of sustain a basic, you know, like, anything you need to get by is basically, you really have to leave Lampeter. So, I think about this a lot, actually, because I think about choice, about how infinite, you know, I live in London now, and, you know, I have infinite choice, really. And I wonder how much of that level of choice actually makes me happy on a day-to-day basis. I know that if I was completely deprived of choice, I wouldn't be happy. But I also think that the opposite is also true. And I think there's something about that scale of life that you get in a Welsh market town that is actually like, they've got a lot right. You know, there's a lot right about living. And I remember about 13 years ago, maybe, I remember we went on holiday to Aberystwyth, and our daughters, I got two daughters, so at the time they were like, well, they would have been about 8 and 11 or 7 and 10 or something, and it was the last weekend before the beginning of term, and we hadn't bought them any shoes. They didn't have their new school shoes to start the term, and we were driving through Aberaeron, and for people who don't know, Aberaeron is a town probably similar size to Lampeter, a market town, again, coastal market town between Aberystwyth and Lampeter. And we thought we'd sort of stop off there for lunch, and we noticed that there was a shoe shop in Aberaeron maybe we can get their shoes there. And the amazing thing, you know, like they're used to sort of this experience of going to like a shoe shop, Clark's in London, and then there's a lovely kind of window display and then displays inside, and you say what shoes do you like the look of, and they say that one and that one, and then they go and get them from behind, and lo and behold, they don't have them in the right size, but suddenly, you know, you're kind of bonded to those, you know, those are the shoes that you wanted. And and then it becomes a bit kind of, you know, stressful because you're trying to manage their expectations and at the same time manage sort of what's there. The shoe shop in Aberaeron obviated all of this, avoided all of this, because there was no display. There were these two women who were like middle-aged, had been doing it all their lives, and they said, what size are they? And I, you know, told them their size, and they went out the back and just got all the shoes that were in that size, all the girls' shoes that were in that size. I said, here you are. And within 10 minutes, they measured them. They had some kind of ninja kind of measuring device, which wasn't kind of computerized. It was like Reiki or something. It was like some sort of kind of like stunt Reiki, whereby they kind of like, they knew which pressure points to kind of, because they'd been doing it all their lives. They were just foot experts. And like, and everything happened really, really quickly within 5 minutes, because those are the shoes that are available. That's your size. And I had two happy children whose expectations have been managed. And it was the least stressful child shoe buying experience I will ever have in my life. And I just thought, that's a thing that there's something to learn from that. There's something to learn about the way, you know, that's exactly how much freedom I think you need to make you content in life.
Yeah, and you're right, because it was such a small place and everything was so concentrated that it was almost like too easy, because, yeah, you had to travel that much further to get there, that in a sense there was a bit of a pilgrimage trip. But once you were there, you kind of didn't need, actually in my case in later years, I did need to get away. I used to go to the cinema a lot, so a trip down to Swansea or Cardiff on a Saturday was a real treat. But I spent all those years there. And of course, you know, sure, there may not have been a cinema, but there was an arts hall which did a film on a Sunday night. And even in the shops, as you say, you know, you'd walk in to buy, I was looking for a packet of like TDK video cassettes, and I went to, is it Jenkins of Farmers, I think, just by the old Porter's Lodge. And of course they come in there and they greet you at the door and they ask what you want. And sometimes I was a bit like, you know, here I am again, because I want to do some more recording off the TV, you know, but they would always show me what they had, and they'd always say, you know, come back and we've got stuff in our storeroom, so don't worry if, you know, we'll have another delivery next week. But there was a personal touch, and I kind of missed that when I was in the anonymous city. But that notion of counterpoint, I think, is really interesting, which you must have felt, you know, growing up in Birmingham. And it leaves its mark on you. It took me a while to feel ready to go back to Lampeter, I think, because I'd been there for so long. Mm. I kind of need just to step away.
Where did you stay?
Well, when I was in Lampeter. Yeah. I was in, so Burgess in my first year, I lived in a house on the North Road, on the way up towards the Bryn in the second and third year. But then I was on the high street for a few years in a house called Beechwood that you may remember James, who I think also was a philosopher and was very much around in that period. He owned the house, and then later on then I was renting with another lecturer in the room.
It was James, kind of northeastern guy.
He used to sit in the Newbridge, the cafe of the Newbridge cafe a lot, and he'd be there and everybody would of course stop him and ask him questions.
The guy with the barber jacket and the kind of curly hair.
Yes, that's him.
Oh, wow. Yeah, he was quite an enigma. He was a bit of a role model of mine, because I do a lot of work in cafes now, and I have a couple of cafes that I kind of really, I mean, really, my book, Broken Greek, was a lot of it was written in two cafes in particular, which I sort of used in the same way that James used the Newbridge, and which I loved. I mean, the Newbridge itself is scorched in my memory, you know, my regular order, sausage, egg, beans and chips, round of bread and butter, pot of tea for one or two, depending on who was there with me. And, the cafe as office, that's just, that to me, that is a charmed state. That is a perfectly happy situation. I don't think I'd have written the book if I wasn't able to use cafes as offices.
Yeah, and I was thinking of that. Was you mentioned at the end of the book, I think it was, that you'd written it over a period of time in cafes. And I was fascinated by that process because your ability to recall is phenomenal. And I'm guessing that undoubtedly you have a very good memory, but I don't know the extent to which you were able to draw on records from the past. I mean, literally records, I didn't mean that, but certainly from sort of data from the past, because it was encyclopedic, but also incredibly accurate. I was taken on a journey with you, because I remember that period. I think you're maybe a couple of years older than me, but utterly everything from Dexys, Midnight Runners, you know, even Julian Cope on Top of the Pops, you know, that was my era. And reading that, and I'm sure that the reason the book did so well is because so many people just looked at the care that you put into it, but also thought, that's my story. I mean, your story is unique, of course, but everybody can tap into that and the aspects of the autobiography around it, which are compelling.
Well, you write it in the hope that it will resonate, because otherwise it will be self-indulgent and people aren't going to get to the end. So as a writer, I'm constantly trying to put myself in the position of the reader. And, you know, and as a reader, I know what works for me. You know, I really appreciate it when the writer makes it easy for me. I don't want it to be a struggle. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of knew that, I really needed to try and put the reader in my headspace, and really sort of that. It's very easy to. I'm amazed how many people forget what it's like being a child, especially parents. I mean, you know, if you go into parenthood, you really need to remember how confusing the world is when you're a child. And you know, and one of my big worries when I was writing the book was that people would think. It was like I was writing a misery memoir, that I was trying to compete with people that had genuinely traumatic kind of upbringings. And that really mortified me, the idea that people might think that I was like, you know, that I thought I was on a kind of, I was trying to be Malala or something. And so I sort of, what I realized after I finished it, I hadn't written a misery memoir. That wasn't what I was even trying to do. But what I was probably trying to do was write a confusion memoir. I was trying to, I don't know if the genre of confusion memoirs exists already. If it hasn't, I would like to sort of lay claim to maybe have invented it, although I suspect that I haven't. But anyway, it's a confusion memoir. And because, you know, everything you do in the first 10 years of your life, especially, is operating from a position of ignorance. So you really have to, as a writer, as the person, as a storyteller, you're having to sort of stop and say, and really draw on that perpetual, like beneath the surface, you know, there's just, your head is just a jumble of question marks. And that's why I really want, you know, I knew from the outset what the first sort of scene had to be. You know, I was in the back of my parents' car, and there was a music playing. And, you know, even when you listen to music when you're six or seven, a song comes on the radio, and it's not like now where you can kind of look it up. You might even, if you're listening on Spotify, sometimes even a photograph of the band comes up. You can call on biographical information. Everything is kind of abstract. Everything is kind of out in the ether. Very little is anchored to empirical knowledge that you have gained about how the world is. So, which is why I wanted to sort of set the scene of like being in the back of my parents' car, listening to this song, which was When I Need You by Leo Sayer. And this almost synesthetic kind of feeling of loveliness kind of washing over me. Whereas like When I Need You was, I knew those emotions, or I knew a version of those emotions. They were sort of emotions that I felt about my mum. You know, it's a song about being dependent on someone. And, you know, the only love you really know at that age is the sort of love you feel for your parents. And that kind of cocoon sort of safety. And we were sort of on our way to this. I was between the ages of four and seven. I was in elective mute, I think is the term, or selective mute. I keep forgetting which is the one you should use these days. But I didn't talk. Apart from my parents, I didn't talk to anyone. And we can go into that later. But basically, I was kind of silent. And and we were going to see a specialist, and I didn't know where we were going. I sort of had an idea of like what we want to got there. I certainly knew what was going to happen, you know, and a trained specialist was going to try and persuade me to start talking. But everything was confusing, you know, and that's why on the first page I mentioned things like Mastermind, the game Mastermind, which looks, there's a photo, it was like a board game with pegs that you put in holes, but the kind of branding of it looked very similar to the program, the TV program Mastermind. And I thought, well, they're clearly connected, but I don't know how they're connected. I don't understand. You know, I don't understand. I didn't know, you know, people would sometimes talk about Fred Astaire, and I thought that was Freddie Starr. I thought those were the same people. The Pink Panther. Why is there a cartoon I really love called The Pink Panther, but there's also a film called The Pink Panther, and there isn't a Pink Panther in that, apart from in the opening credits to, I think, one of the films, a Pink Panther. What is that? I don't understand. You know, I don't know. You know, there's so little you understand. And so that was the kind of base point from which I proceeded. And of course, what you say about music, the recollection of music, that's music for me anyway, was a sort of proxy, which kind of proxy means by which I understood my life, understood my situation. And thank you for observing the kind of, hopefully it was accurate. I really tried to make a lot of the stuff I remembered, a lot of stuff I wasn't sure about, I sort of augmented with research.
Yeah, and I think what really works in that, though, is that it's almost as though each week you're looking at what was going on in the charts, and in that same week, there were, I mean, I've done the same as well in the whole sort of way that you think, you know, that's when we went on holiday. I talked to my mum, I think, actually, you mentioned Leo Say, that was, what, 76, wasn't it? And I don't remember this, so I've got her memory. Now, she says that she doesn't remember this, but many years later, she said that when we were on holiday, I think it was in Tenby in the summer of 76, in that long, hot summer, she associates it with Demis Roussos and Forever and Ever. So of course, for me, I thought Long Hot Summer, that was number one around that time. And I mentioned to her a few years ago, and I said, you know, I seem to have inherited your memory, because I don't remember it as a primary memory, but a secondary one. And she said, oh, I can't remember that at all. So I've got in my mind floating around a combination of accurate, inaccurate, other people's memories that all conjoined, and memories are often composite. But what I think you did, you disaggregate them. And also, you know, whether Julian Cope really was in the state of mind on Top of the Pops that you mentioned, it almost doesn't matter, because that is exactly what you remember. And, you know, and it was a very sort of transgressive time as well, whether it was Phil Oakey from the Human League or Adamant or Boy George a bit later, in the way that they dressed. And for someone, you know, growing up in a very kind of traditional sort of home, suddenly to see a man with makeup or an earring, you know, it seemed really different. And of course, the Dare album was actually the first one that my sister and I bought. And all these years later, I still listen to it. So of course, those initial memories are really going to take effect, or listening in the chip shop to Radio One, of course. And I think that's really important. But did you keep a diary? I know you obviously kept records, very meticulous records at the time.
Yeah.
But you know, to what extent did you have to draw on those kind of resources to write the book?
I briefly kept a diary in 1982, which I still have. It wasn't very useful, actually, because what you do as a child when you keep a diary is you write down a version of your life. In a way, when you write a diary, it's the first time that you're self-conscious. You're trying to present to, presumably, posterity, a view of your life, which isn't necessarily accurate. And children don't really write down, certainly at the age of 12 anyway, write down the deep emotional stuff that they're feeling. So it often tends to be what you had for tea, and, you know, maybe something funny that someone said in the playground, or, you know, someone got told off or something. But actually, for the kind of big emotional stuff, it was just kind of my memory, really. And that's why music was so useful, you know, because I don't know if this works to this degree for other people, but, you know, it really was absolutely time and time again. I just found that, you know, the records I loved were just sort of, there was a reason I loved them. You know, they were offering a kind of accidental commentary on what was happening in my interior world. And even when they weren't doing that exactly, they were sort of an imperfect mirror to what was going on. And And that was why I liked them. I think that's why, probably why I like a lot of music now. You know, a lot of the music I like now, it sort of feels like it kind of existential sort of authentication of an outlook I already have evolved through my own life, my own experiences.
Yeah, and I think particularly when there is so much flux, or people, of course, will have, particularly with music, you know, people are very proprietorial about their musical tastes. That in my case, sometimes, you know, I don't care anymore because, you know, I was never the cool guy in the school playground. You know, first record I bought was the first single was Buck's Fizz Making Your Mind Up, and of course that was always the one that was like, oh, you know, that's not really the coolest thing you could listen to. It's a Eurovision number. But all those years on, that doesn't matter. And I'm so completely like, well, that was the stuff I listened to. And it's also when that comes on, the power, the sense of empowerment, even like in an arts hall disco, there was one year when it was lots of like house stuff, early 90s, and it was a Christmas party, but I thought, this is not Christmas music. Where's Joni Louis? And suddenly they played Don't You Want Me, which of course is a Christmas, you know, it was Christmas number one, it's a Christmas record. And I thought, I can't dance, I don't care. I went on, and for me, for those 3 or 4 minutes, I was on that dance floor in the arts hall just before Christmas, 92 it would have been, and I thought, this is my moment, because I'm imbibed, because that would only be like 11 years after it was first a hit, but suddenly for me, that was my childhood. I owned that stage. And if anybody said, you know, maybe they were too polite, but if anyone said, you know, oh, you can't dance, it's like, doesn't matter, I was in my moment. That was my indulgence for 4 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, one of the sort of things I almost militantly tried to adhere to in the book was, there was no need to say it explicitly, but hopefully it comes through in the book, is there's no, you know, it's not, there's nothing stupid about, you know, like buying a record at the, you know, like, how old were you when you bought Making Your Mind Up?
I was seven, six going on seven.
Okay. You were seven. I think often there's a temptation to sort of look back on your life at the kind of uncool things that you're into and characterize these decisions as sort of stupid decisions, or kind of, you know, characterize the person that kind of bought that record or saw that film or whatever as sort of dumb, or someone who was sort of not yet clever enough to not buy that record. And I really want to get away from this idea that it's even the concepts like that are appropriate to describing the behavior of children. The wonderful thing about being a child is that you have this kind of honesty. You like what you like, and there's nothing sort of, you have your reasons, you know, at the age of seven, you have your reasons, and they're good reasons. They're good reasons that a seven-year-old will have for sort of doing things, and you can't apply concepts like clever or stupid to them. That's just how seven, you know. And it's interesting to me that as an adult, if you're, you know, as a parent now, you know, if you're hanging around with, if you're doing so, you're going out for the afternoon with two 10-year-old children. One of those 10-year-old children is happy being 10. They will just, you know, any kind of interaction you have, they will sort of honestly, you know, impart their 10-year-old's perspective. Actually, and then the other 10-year-old is actually kind of trying to act like they're 13 or 15. The 10-year-old who's trying to act a little bit older or a bit cooler is, if you have to apply the word dumb or whatever, or, you know, any kind of value judgment along those lines on one of those children, you would apply it to the child that is actually trying to behave more like an adult, to the one that they're the one that will seem more immature. Well, actually, a 10-year-old child that just behaves like a 10-year-old child, well, you know, everyone knows where they stand. They're actually quite rather good company. You know, you can actually be yourself, and a 10-year-old child can be themselves. And you know what the terms of engagement are. And that's actually a very nice thing to do. And so at some subconscious level, we understand that. And we adjust instinctively as adults. We kind of, I remember like really enjoying hanging around my children, you know, at those ages, because they weren't trying to be anything that they weren't. It was just lovely.
Yeah. And I mean, in my case, I think that even the music from that era that kind of passed me by at the time, still can 35, 40 years on, suddenly, I'll give you an example. I woke up the other morning and I thought, what is this song going around my head? And it's not even a song I remember. It turned out it was at number 10 in 82. It was Cliff Richard, The Only Way Out. And I thought, why is that song suddenly now going around my head? And of course, it was there at the time, but it's almost like it's like, I don't care what's in the charts now. It's really funny. When my children were born, my eldest is 9, so you know I looked them all up, but I can't remember. But you know, I can hear Pick of the Pops on a Saturday and immediately I'll say, oh, number one will be, you know, Shaking Stevens' Oh Julie or whatever it might be. And it's like, how do I know that? It's odd that 40 years on. Dionne Warwick, Heartbreaker is another one, perfectly good song, but kind of passed me by a little bit at the time. But suddenly, about 3-4 years ago, suddenly I think I saw it on one of the old Top of the Pops, and I just thought, actually, this is a good classy song. But again, you know, why those songs, you know, necessarily? And I think there's something about a particular era that we are very precious about, and there's nothing worse than somebody else dismissing it and saying, oh, you know, your tastes are just rubbish, because what they're effectively then saying is that your experiences are not authentic and your autobiography is flawed. And that, I think, is where, you know, that's where music plays such a seminal role.
A couple of things I'd pick up there. First of all, you're a theologian, so maybe the reason why you remember The Only Way Out is, I think it's a song about his religious faith, and maybe that's a factor. That is very interesting to me. That because what's interesting to me is how we, as slightly insecure human beings in pop cultural, in pop literate Britain in the 21st century, have actually created systems by which we get to almost process, we process the embarrassment of liking records that we feel that we probably shouldn't like. And that's what guilty pleasures is. Guilty pleasure. And, you know, I understand, you know, like the thing, I often mention guilty pleasures these days and people say, oh, well, I don't think there should be anything such thing as a guilty pleasure. You either like what you like or you don't. And yeah. And actually, I slightly take issue with that view. I think any construct that exists because it has some work to do. And guilty pleasures is the case. But it's fine. You know, there's, okay, you don't believe in guilty pleasures, fine. Maybe I don't believe in, you know, I'm a music journalist, and as you've read the book, I'm a music journalist who is in no way trying to be cool. You know, I like so much stuff that is critically beyond the pale. It's clear that I don't believe in guilty pleasures. It doesn't matter. The reason that guilty pleasures is there as a construct, it's a quarantine area for music, pop music, that people place it into this quarantine area so that it can be so that it can join the queue to be reevaluated by the wider world. And we saw one of the kind of most interesting early instances in which we saw this happening was when after a decade in which it was very uncool to say that you liked ABBA, that decade being the 80s, of course, then Polydor, who had inherited the ABBA back catalogue, decided that they would put a new ABBA hits compilation out. There hadn't been one for a long time. And so they did a lot of market research, focus groups, and so forth. They put together a number of different record sleeves, well, CD sleeves, some of which had photographs of ABBA on them, different things. The one that rated best of all in focus groups was a plain black sleeve with just the ABBA logo in gold, and it said ABBA gold, and that was the one which just seemed kind of coolest to people. And you know, we all know that, you know, it went on to be, you know, one of the biggest, I think along with Queen's greatest hits, one of the biggest selling compilation albums of all time. At the time, I remember, you know, people would say, oh, I love ABBA. They're so bad, they're good. You know, that was the thing that people said about ABBA. oh, I shouldn't like ABBA, but they're kind of, I did, you know. And then the Guilty Pleasures phenomenon came on the back of that. About 3 years later, there was a club called Guilty Pleasures, which became very successful very quickly. And there was a compilation that went alongside it that had songs like Silver Lady by David Soul, Living Thing by ELO, Andrew Gold, Never Let Her Slip Away, all those songs, Storm in a Teacup by The Fortunes, which I think is literally one of the 20 greatest singles ever made. And what we were seeing here was a sort of quite everything, you know, the punk generation sort of basically calling an amnesty on these uncle records, partly because they wanted them in their lives and putting them into this quarantine area. And what we saw with ABBA, who won the first bands to be put in this quarantine, was the public, you know, popular culture passes a verdict. They say, shall we put you back in the 70s where and not listen to you again, or shall we actually stop saying you're so bad you'll go, we will just start saying we love you. And that's no one ever says about ABBA now, oh, that music's so terrible, actually I really really like it. We love ABBA. Everyone loves ABBA. You know, people who don't love ABBA these days are quite rightly treated, you know, like perverts or something. I'm joking, that's kind of happened with a lot of that music. Something like Silver Lady. We all know Silver Lady is an amazing song. Of course it is. That's why it survived. So I think that's how it works.
Yeah, and Silver Lady is great because it's got, you never quite, it's one of those songs where you never quite know where it's going because it's got two completely different kind of melodies going on and it just sort of comes together and you can, you know, you can like the two of them quite independently. But ABBA, you're right, in Lampeter down the Union, certainly early 90s, they were always playing ABBA.
Yeah, I used to play
them. And they'd all come and everyone would dress up and they'd sort of plan to hijack the jukebox for the evening and dress up in sort of ABBA gear and they'd have like a proper 70s kitsch night.
Yeah, I always used to DJ with them often. And it was the last record of the night, and I think I was probably one of the you know, like people of my generation, my age, were probably some of the first people who, when they were DJing, would just play these songs, and you know, and the scenes of euphoria you would witness, you know, were just magnificent, you know. And I loved that. I loved actually finding those records where people might sort of think, you're playing that, you know. And because Lampeter, as you know, had this fantastic record shop, which was situated at the time above a travel agent called Hag's Records. And for people who won't know, Hag was this kind of polymath local character who was not only the local Labour councillor, but had a window cleaning round. And I think he was involved in the local football team as well. And ran a record shop, which he'd run almost since he was a student there, since he left. And Hags was actually probably the reason I ultimately stayed in Lampeter, because I was so addicted to going to record shops that, you know, I was already deeply homesick 3 days, you know, 3 days after arriving there. And then I saw a little sandwich board on the pavement which said Hags Records this way. And I went up this wooden rickety staircase, kind of a bit scared, because when you go to a shop that's above another shop, you don't know what you'll find. and I just thought, in that moment, I thought, okay, I can stay here for 3 years. And I went in and I bought the Notorious Bird Brothers, which is an album by the Birds. And so I will always associate that album with just, you know, being away from home properly for the first time in this beautiful place, kind of trying to just figure out this strange turn my life had taken. And this kind of, again, this synesthetic, beautiful synesthetic haze of Magic Mountain, which I can see behind you. And this lovely kind of slightly autumnal kind of woozy, psychedelic folk pop album, folk rock album by the Birds. And it's all the same, all one.
And what I thought was really powerful in the book as well was, of course, the story, which I think you tease us a little bit, because we never quite know what happens. But of course, it's about, as a child, what you perceive about your parents and what happens with arguments and rows. And I thought, and so obviously there is a second part to the story, so I'm not expecting you to tell us here. But I thought it was very powerfully done, that from a child's eye, that it was like the music was a good way of sort of retreating into something mentally. You could, a bit like, I suppose, Shawshank Redemption, sort of, you know, the way that music can allow you to, yeah, in your head go somewhere when around you is perhaps chaos. And and I thought that was really powerfully done. And and so there obviously is a second part to this story, but the degree to which family matters to you is so palpable in the story, and also the neighbors. And I think I came across something, it may have been, I don't know if it was on Twitter, I don't know where I read it, on one of your reviews of Broken Greek, and it was your next door neighbor who you referred to in the book, and she said, hey, I was, you know, I'm in the book. So I thought you've even used the same names. I mean, is that right, the names are all the
names have changed, but in that instance, so my neighbor, again, for people who haven't read the book, my neighbor was a girl who was 4 years older than me. She was called Geraldine, but we all called her Jed. Jed was her name. And because I'm still friends with Jed was one of the few people in the book who I could say, look, can I just use your real name? You're going to have to trust, you know, I didn't show her the book. I didn't show her anything. And I kept saying, you know, like occasionally, you know, I'd call her, or we'd meet at a festival or something, or I'd go back to Birmingham, see her in Birmingham, because she's a librarian in Birmingham, at the big central library in Birmingham now. And I would keep saying to her, Jed, people are going to love you. If people read this book, whatever they think about the book, they're going to love you, because you're just one of those people who lands on the page so well. I just feel like, you know, it's a gift I scarcely deserve to have you, to be able to put you in the book. Because she was 4 years older than me. She lived next door. So she was like a sort of surrogate older sister. And she was endlessly patient. And she came from, her family were, you know, a kind of family, actually. I'm not sure that that kind of family exists so much, proliferates so much as it sort of did then. Very post-war, working class, but very self-improving working class. So very much a product of the post-war sort of welfare state, you know, the boom in libraries, a real sense that, you know, we've come through two wars and, you know, we're lucky to be here. And, you know, and there's a sort of municipal realm to life, to civic life, that we can all enjoy, and we can all use it to try and be the best people we can, not only for ourselves but to each other. And they were very much an example of that kind of family. Jed, you know, we moved next door, you know, I was just almost 10 years old. And I'd never met a family like that, because we were like, my mum was from Athens, my dad was Cypriot, and my mum was really trying to become like a middle class kind of bourgeois, kind of, you know, that dream, you know, that sort of the net curtains, the kind of the lovely floral pattern sofas, carpets everywhere, because why would you not have a carpet? Carpets are great, you know. She didn't have a carpet in the kind of slightly basic kind of dwellings in Athens where she grew up. She was very poor, you know. Anyway, that's another story. But we met we moved into this house, and then one of the first things that happened was Jed's mum, Joyce, who, you know, sadly passed away early last year. She knocked on the door. And with a cake, and, you know, she didn't know. What I love about this is, when, if you're the kind of person that welcomes the new neighbors, and you knock on the door and you're there with a kind of cake that you made, you don't know what you're going to find. You know, those, your new neighbors could be an absolute nightmare, and there you are, just standing on the door, completely open. She found, you know, it transpired obviously very quickly that we're Greek, and she was she loved the fact that suddenly her next door neighbors were Greek, because she could find out all about these people that were very different to her. And we went to her house, and I went to their house at some point, and they had, you know, aesthetically, they were very different to us. They had, you know, they had that kind of arts and craftsy, self-improving, like I said, that kind of post-war working class thing. They had wooden floors. And my mum was so bewildered by this because why would you have wooden floors when you can afford carpets? And they had, they didn't have a color television. They had a little black and white television in the front room, which took second, which was very much took, you know, was second place to the piano. They had a piano and they could play it. Wow. You know, and they had a, and in the kitchen, my mother, you know, again, that kind of Athenian middle class kind of, you know, obsessively hygienic thing. They had this really heavy frying pan that they never washed. And my mum couldn't understand why they didn't wash this frying pan. I think she kind of maybe mentioned it politely. Says, oh, what? And apparently it was, and now I know that, you know, with those really old heavy pans, you go, you know, if you wash them, it'll ruin it because you season them and, you know. So it's this pan that they, and my mum just couldn't understand why they didn't, you know, because they were such lovely people. Anyway, Jed was the teenager there, 4 years older than me, and she taught me so much about music. She loved Paul Simon. First time I heard Paul Simon was over by her. She was the person who told me that Paul McCartney and John Lennon were in the same band, had been in the same band together, which blew my mind. Still blows my mind in a way. And she was just endlessly tolerant of me.
Yeah. Now, this is funny what you said that, because you're right, because I remember probably the first Paul McCartney I heard was Top of the Pops and Take It Away. And I thought, you know, somebody said he was in the Beatles. And I thought, what, the guy who did Take It Away was in the Beatles? Oh, my God. You know, sort of as if somehow the Beatles were sort of inconsequential and paved the way for this amazing sort of number that was my entry into Paul McCartney.
And that's, again, that goes back to what I was saying at the beginning about how you really need to remember what it was, not this kind of imagine, not this kind of like I Heart the 70s talking head kind of, you know, on Channel 4 or whatever, you know, that, you know, Kate Thornton trying to pretending that she has got a clue who 10cc were or whatever, you know, really, really remember, because of course you're nine or whatever. And why, you know, no one was talking about the Beatles in the 1970s. No one was, apart from Jed next door to my house. And so, of course, he was Paul McCartney from Wings. And, you know, there's so much orthodoxy that you just inherit. And is it actually your opinion, or have you just inherited other people's opinions? And Mull of Kintyre is a classic example of this. You know, people just sort of, so many people that just don't stop to actually ask, what do I think about this? Not what have I inherited? What have, and, you know, the most moronic example of this is people who say, Ringo Starr, best drummer in the world, wasn't even the best drummer in the Beatles. That's just like the, you know, okay, I understand inheriting halfway decent opinions, but when you inherit an opinion that's as utterly moronic as that one, and you pass it, and you think it's kind of fun. Well, Ringo Starr was the best drummer in the world, you know, and I'm not going to go down that route, but there are moments in Beatles songs where I would say that's a demonstrable truth. But anyway, we inherit these opinions, and, you know, and Mull of Kintyre by Wings, which I just, you know, again, it goes back to that thing of like, it's impossible to have a stupid opinion when you're seven. You just assimilate what you know from the world around you, and you do your best to sort of process it into an opinion or an impression. And Mull of Kintyre, why would I not have liked Mull of Kintyre when I was seven or eight? It was made by this palpably lovely man. You know, the video had these scenes of kind of domestic loveliness. It had a beautiful melody. It completely succeeded in its objectives to write about this beautiful place and the feeling of well-being that you get from it. And it had bagpipes, and as we all know, you know, bagpipes were, you know, like we all knew as children, we were all very familiar, we were all very bagpipe literate, because we watched Blue Peter, and for some reason every fortnight on Blue Peter they'd open the big kind of the big sort of service doors of the studio through which like lorries would go in, or kind of fancy tractors or whatever. And, you know, 15 bagpipe players, 15 fusiliers would kind of walk in, and play some bagpipes, always for a different reason. But Blue Peter seemed to be obsessed with bagpipes. So we were all very bagpipe literate. There was nothing about Mullivkintyre that was surprising to us. And it's still, I still get emotional when I hear that song.
Yeah. And also what was really, I think, powerful in the book was the other neighbours, like the man next door, yeah, who at first was very suspicious of this family coming over from somewhere else with a different heritage. Yeah. And then how he cried on Christmas Day when he'd been a bit rude to you all, but you you gave him a Christmas. And the other neighbours, when your mum was in hospital, who always seemed a bit sort of standoffish, yeah, but then visited your mum and brought some food around for you. And that came across as really touching, because I remember people like that. And, you know, they were sort of always a bit busy body or a bit kind of full of themselves, but sometimes I guess maybe there's a basic humanity in everyone, which when a mother's in hospital and the children are at home, that actually people do show their true colors, and that I found that very moving.
Yeah. And I talk to this sometimes, you know, with my mum. You know, I've said to her, and she's seen, you know, she's read the book as well, and I said that's like one of the most beautiful things. You know, I just want, as an example of parenting, I hope you're really proud of that. That's why I mentioned it. But so basically, the racist neighbour, Bert Chance, we moved into this house in 1977, I think, and we had this widower neighbour, lived on his own, very, you know, very anti-foreigners, very anti-immigration. And so we were his worst nightmare. Suddenly, you know, foreigners were living next door to him. Never happened to him before. Very hostile to us. Very hostile to my dad, especially, because he thought that the fact that he had a nice car, why should he have a nice car when there are British people driving around in inferior cars? Yeah, all that sort of thing. And my mum just used to sort of tell us to sort of, my mum said, we always had to be nice to him. That was just the rule, you know. And then on Christmas Day, which was Christmas Day 77, I think, my mum had this uncanny knack of preparing Christmas dinner just at the exact point at which Christmas Top of the Pops was about to start. And I don't wish to seem ungrateful, but of course I am ungrateful. I wasn't grateful because I resented it. I wanted to watch Top of the Pops. But and she said, she prepared an extra plate, and she said quite firmly to me and my brother, I want you to go over and give this to Bert next door. And I was like, oh, Mum, you know, okay. So we sort of like, we knocked on the door, and he just took one. He opened the door, and which took him a while to even get to the door because he had a false leg. He had which we would hear him unscrewing every night through the walls of the house. And he burst into tears. Just something completely broke down in him when he saw it. It was just that simple act of like kindness that we'd remembered him. And that just sort of stayed with me so much, actually, that I remember. But about maybe about 13 years ago or something, I remember, like, in our adult life now in London, I remember we had my parents sort of staying over for Christmas. And there was a Venezuelan family that lived across the road from us. And the mum was called Carla. And they had one daughter who was about five or six. She was heavily pregnant, and she was due to give birth on Christmas Eve. And I'd said to her kind of some weeks beforehand, look, you know, you don't know if you're going to be in hospital on Christmas Day or whatever, like, don't bother preparing Christmas dinner. We'll bring everything over to you. Don't worry, we won't forget. We'll bring you, because we've got a big turkey. Well, we've got everything to do some extra portions. It's going to be there anyway. And so and that's what we did. And my mum saw me getting it ready. She said, that's a really nice thing that you're doing. I said, well, I learned it from you. I learned it. It's what you did with Bert. I'm just copying you. And so that was kind of, that stayed with it. And then my children saw us doing it. And no doubt maybe my children, you know, when they're older, they might have occasion to do it. But I've noticed generally, I think that on social media, and especially on Twitter, where people, you know, sometimes someone pops into my timeline and says something quite angry and rude, or they kind of make an assumption about something I've said. And I try and engage them politely, because I just sort of think that often they sort of think that, you know, you just can't see them. They're just trying to sort of like, these people are just, they think they've been forgotten. And if you just sort of give them that bit of attention, and you sort of, sometimes even if you apologize, even if you don't really feel like you've got anything to apologize for, the mere act of just acknowledging them in that way just disarms them straight away. You know, that's just the best hope we've got, really, I think. And that goes back to what happened with Bert, you know, all those years ago.
Yeah, and those customs and traditions, I think are really well brought out. I'm conscious of the time, because we've probably only got time.
Don't worry. I mean, 10 minutes is fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I always do at this point in the interviews is sort of ask a few questions around memories, and whether your memories are positive, and whether perhaps it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. How would you feel about that, looking back on your life and career?
Yeah, I think you're allowed to be nostalgic about negative experiences, because you are. I mean, there are two kinds of nostalgia. I guess there's a kind of nostalgia where some people maybe think it was genuinely better. Maybe some people, do want to go back to rationing and or whatever it is. Maybe they think that actually they would be sort of happier by doing that. But I sort of think that there's, you know, in writing the book, I allowed myself to be nostalgic about everything, you know, and it just felt like nostalgia is sometimes maybe, you know, a means of trying to control the past, or to sort of mold it into something that you can understand. And, you know, when I wrote the book, I was, you know, I didn't know if I was going to finish it to start. I thought I'll just start writing. But, it was definitely, it was an escape I allowed myself, you know. There were certain stressful things going on in my life elsewhere. Some people close to me weren't very well. And actually, it was just an escape, really, to start with. I didn't really understand why I was escaping, what I was escaping to, what I was escaping from, but it just felt like a place. It just felt like a place I could control, and I could actually start to kind of allow myself to understand what had happened to me, and perhaps, you know, a little bit why I am the way I am now.
And was it something that you had always had this sort of burning ambition to do? I mean, my grandfather always wanted to write his life story, and he did it in his 80s, when he met my grandmother in the Second World War. So it took him decades to do it, but he always wanted to do it. But was it something that came from you, or was it, other people who said, you've got this amazing story, you must tell it? Or was it like a combination of the two?
I didn't think I was capable of writing a book. I just thought books were something that people far cleverer than me did. But there was one person who, approached me 20 years ago, pretty much now, I think, when I had a staff job at Time Out magazine, and she was called Katie, and she took me out for lunch and said, I can't even remember what publisher she worked for at the time, but she said, "Have you got? I think you'd write a good book. I like the stuff you did for Time Out, and I think, you know, I can imagine you writing a good book." And I said, "Well, I'd just become a dad. You know, if I can't. There's just no way. I don't even have any ideas for a book, let alone any sense of the time in which I could do it, because I'm just trying to stay afloat, just looking after my kids and all that sort of stuff." She said, "Well, it's fine. You know, so can you just sort of? Will it be annoying if I just call you every couple of years and ask you if you've changed your mind?" And I said, "No, of course it wouldn't. You know, I'm very, very flattered that you you're interested." And then, so when I started writing the book, I thought the first thing I need to do is find a literary agent. I found an agent, and then Katie, who by this time was working for Quercus, who were, published the book, found out via my agent that I had actually started work on a book, and she kind of emailed me. She said, "Is it true what I'm hearing?" And I said, "Yeah, it's true. Don't worry. Like, as soon as I have anything that I think you might want to read, you'll be the first person I send it to. But I'm just going to write the whole thing, you know." And I did. And you know, it was very brave of her to take a chance on it, because it's twice as long as most books of that nature no one really knows who I am. It's a quite brave thing of her to sort of get behind it and say, and not say, oh, well, you just need to cut it in half because no one's going to buy it at that length. But actually, she did the first thing she said, we just need to make a feature of it. It just kind of needs to be this long. And I will forever be grateful to her for that.
And I'm so glad that worked out, because this sort of question I always ask everyone about whether, if they can sort of think back to their younger self, their 7-year-old self or 17-year-old self, and, you know, could you ever have imagined when you were younger what you'd be doing now? And, you know, conversely, what sort of advice would you give your younger self based on where you are now? I mean, you've reflected on these very issues, of course, through the process of writing. But, you know, could you, or did your family, have ever imagined that you'd be doing what you're doing now?
No. I mean, I never thought I'd even be a music director. I never thought I'd make a living out of writing. I just thought it was just something much cleverer people did. And and the only reason it happened really is a sort of a function of my love of music, my love of records. The only advice I'd give the 7-year-old me is, even later on in life, when it seems like having good manners and trying to be kind, we don't always remember to be kind, but, you know, just don't underestimate the power of that, because I think there were times in my life when I probably did underestimate it, or maybe tried too hard to run with a kind of cooler gang of people and their values, and I sort of now know that, in a way, you know, I think 10-year-old me in many ways was kind of a much smarter than 25-year-old me. And I kind of wish I'd kind of honoured that person's outlook at all times in my life.
Yeah. And my very last question, Pete, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Both. But I think the kind of looking back I do is very different to the kind of looking forward. So I look forward practically, but I look back sentimentally.
A perfect answer. Pete, this has been a dream come true for me. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
I wish that view could stay. It's such a lovely view.